Hey, Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In August, the U.S. Census Bureau released some extraordinary findings. They announced that the average North Carolina household was no better off economically in 2007 than they were in 2000. Over that period, the typical household saw no change in annual income after adjusting for inflation. This is an extraordinary development because it marks the first time that this has happened. Normally, economic conditions have improved over time. In that same 8-year period from 2000 to 2007, poverty rates also rose, and the number and share of uninsured North Carolinians jumped sharply. What this means is that the economic expansion that drove the early part of the decade failed to benefit most North Carolina families. That's according to one of our guests this hour, John Quintero, a research associate for the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. The center is a division of the North Carolina Justice Center, a statewide nonprofit research and advocacy organization. The Budget and Tax Center provides analysis of state and local budget, tax, and economic issues with a focus on their impact on low and moderate income citizens. And Mr. Quintero joins us for the hour from Raleigh. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
You're welcome. Also with us is Louisa Warren, a policy advocate for the North Carolina Justice Center. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Adam Linker is with us. He is the health policy analyst for the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, another division of the North Carolina Justice Center, which works to ensure that every North Carolinian has affordable, accessible, and high-quality health care services. Adam, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
All three of our guests today join us from the studios of WUNC, actually in Chapel Hill, I guess, not Raleigh. Adam, before we talk about the census numbers and what they mean, I'm intrigued by the description I just read about the Health Access Coalition, which works to, quote, ensure that every North Carolinian has affordable, accessible, and high-quality health care services, end quote. Given the state of the health care system throughout the country, is that really possible, particularly if you don't have health insurance? How successful have you been at that goal?
Well, it's a difficult goal to meet, but we actually have released, and we can talk about this later as we talk about policy proposals, but we have released a guaranteed affordable choice health care plan. You know, the federal government has been very slow to react to try to make up for losses in employer-sponsored insurance. The number of uninsured goes up every year, and so we really need to take action at the state level, and that's sort of what we're advocating is North Carolina needs to be proactive here and actually do something as opposed to just wait for the federal government because, as you have described, you know, there's 500,000 more uninsured than there was in 2000, and so, you know, we've been moderately successful in some ways, but obviously the uninsured, the ranks of the uninsured keep growing every year. So,
you released these findings of the Census Bureau, your organization, the North Carolina Budget, the Justice Center, rather, that say that the average North Carolina household was no better off economically in 2007 than they were in 2000. You released this report in August. Is there any significance to the timing of the release of that information, or was that simply when the Census Bureau made it available?
There was no significance other than the fact that in late August is usually when the Census Bureau makes those figures about household income, poverty rates, and uninsurance available. Mm. So it meets their schedule.
I only asked that question because this comes on the eve of an election, and August was when both political conventions were underway, and I wanted to make sure that there was no political connection to the timing because it doesn't bode well for the incumbent party. John, you say that this is extraordinary because this is the first time on record that household income has remained unchanged and that poverty rates have been higher at the end of an economic expansion than at the beginning. How do you explain that?
Well, I think those developments are, as you said, extraordinary ones. The typical pattern is the economy will have a recession, a downturn, and then it will go into expansion. And at the end of that expansion, ideally, families will, or households should be better off than they were at the beginning. The idea that economic growth will help improve the living standards of all households. What we've seen over the past several years in this current economic cycle that started more or less after the 2001 recession is that it has not been the case. We've had growth, but the benefits of growth have not necessarily connected to family living standards. And a big piece of that, I think, or a big reason why, relates to the job market and how it's performed or not performed in North Carolina and across the country in the past several years.
So the trickle-down isn't working?
No, not necessarily.
Given that the economy, I think it's fairly well acknowledged in all quarters that the economy has fallen on hard times, and if you look at the news over the weekend with yet more investment banking collapses over the weekend, possibly worse times are on the way. What does that mean for those same families whose income stagnated in the face of inflation and for those living in poverty already?
Well, I think what we're going to see is that when the numbers come in for 2008, they're going to be significantly worse than we just saw in 2007. Because, again, the numbers that came out in August that you referenced, Mike, those were for 2007. The Census Bureau numbers are always a year behind.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to 2008, I think you'll see many of the trends will have increased in a negative direction, given the fact that we've seen increasing job loss as well as rising prices for a variety of things.
You know, we've done a lot of shows on this program, and we've heard reports come out, read about them in the paper, et cetera, that say that overall, North Carolina's economy grew substantially, solidly, in recent years. And that's what's extraordinary about this, isn't it? The fact that in the face of a growing, expanding, relatively healthy North Carolina economy, take the rest of the country out of the equation here, that people living and working in North Carolina are not benefiting from it.
I think that is an extraordinary development, and really I think it goes to or points at this disconnection between top-level, big-picture economic growth, which is very important. It's good to have those kinds of trends you referenced. But then the next question is, okay, if you have that growth, how are the benefits of that going to be used? At what point are that going to translate down into living standard, into improvements in the living standards for most families? And that link has been stressed or even broken in the past few years.
So if our economy has been growing and we're relatively healthy, where is the money going that this economy is generating?
Well, really, I think if you look at a variety of factors or data sets, I think it really points to the idea that the benefits of growth have been concentrated overwhelmingly in the hands of a small subset of the population, a small number of households, a small number of firms. That's really where the benefits have gone. And the question is, I think, what role can particularly public policy play in making sure that the benefits are of prosperity and more broadly shared, and that all households and all individuals have access or an opportunity to share in that prosperity.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Joe Biden was in Charlotte over the weekend, and just 20 minutes ago this morning on Morning Edition, we played some of his remarks while he was in Charlotte, and one of the things that he said was that he could walk from Charlotte to Greensboro, and the only person who would say that the economy has been good would be if he ran into John McCain on the way to Greensboro. Would he be right?
Well, I think it all really depends on the perspective. I think if you look at it from a top-level economic perspective, I think folks would think, from that perspective, things look relatively good over the past few years. But if you're looking from the perspective of households, particularly households that work for a living, that depend on the labor market and their jobs to support themselves, support their families, provide the income needed to get ahead and build a better future, I think the answer would be no, that from that perspective, things have not been very good and don't appear very positive at all. And that's the disconnect I started to describe earlier.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to phrase this, but are these people who have been most negatively affected by the stagnating wages and et cetera, and the lack of health care and so forth, are these people that we would normally characterize as people who are economically on the fringe?
No, I would say that for part of that population, when you talk about the folks who maybe are living in extreme poverty, might fit that. But really, when we're talking about, let's say, median household income, you're talking about median. You're talking about the families in the middle. So you're talking not about a small subset of the population, but a broad swath of folks, most households, which really depend on the wages they earn from work to make ends meet. And so we're talking about a fairly broad swath of the population, not just a few isolated examples.
Because we heard, when the price of gasoline began to go up in the spring and stayed up all summer, we heard that this is when people started to complain about inflation and how their wages hadn't kept up with the cost of living. But it's actually been going on much longer than that, according to these Census Bureau numbers that you have released. Is it now just beginning to be noticed by people? Is that what the point of this is? Or have these people noticed it all along?
I think there are a couple of things. One, I think the increase in energy costs and food costs have become very visible very quickly. And so it's really made trends that maybe were that had existed for a while more, it pushed them into people's consciousness. But I think there's certain other trends that are maybe just as serious that folks haven't realized. So we talk about energy and food, but I think healthcare costs have been a silent, sort of a silent issue there, and that those costs have been increasing fairly steadily over recent years, but they haven't quite had the same sort of sticker shock visibility that a big jump in a gallon of milk has, for example. Mm-hmm. And so there are other things at work there, too, and I think things are becoming more visible now.
Your report, which includes these Census Bureau numbers, says that this whole trend is troubling because more people are living in poverty. Many more are in the ranks of the so-called working poor. What's the difference between those two groups, the people already living in poverty and the working poor, or are they one and the same pretty much?
Well, I think that they're not one and the same. They can be one and the same would be the short answer to that. That when we talk in broad terms about who is poor these days, this is the difference of the 90s versus the decade that we're in now. We're really talking about folks who are working, that by and large, most of the folks in society these days are in the labor market in some respect. It may be part-time, it may be full-time, but they are working. And so there's really not much of a population these days when you're talking about folks who are in poverty who are not working. So I think that's important to draw that distinction. Of course, we do have folks who are in more middle income who are also working, but as John pointed out, when we're talking here about the stagnation of median income, we're talking about folks in that middle class. We're also talking about low and moderate income folks who are also struggling, who are seeing that their wages and that the erosion of workplace benefits are not keeping up and making work pay for them.
Hmm. I would add with health insurance, too, you have 80% of people who are uninsured are either working full-time or have someone in their family working full-time. So I think
say that again, 80% of the people who are uninsured?
Yes, most people are uninsured or either working full-time or have someone in their family working sometime. So you would think that they have some connection to employer-sponsored insurance. But really what's driving a lot of the increases in uninsurance is this slow erosion of employer-sponsored insurance.
Hmm. Which we're going to talk about at some length as we go through this program, because I know that you, Adam, as the health policy analyst and your organization, the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, have some, as you already alluded to, some suggestions on how we might improve conditions for these people who are uninsured and how North Carolina might get out in front of the rest of the country in making health insurance available to working people and non-working people alike, I suppose. We'll talk about that. Adam Linker is with us, also Louisa Warren, a policy advocate for the North Carolina Justice Center, and much of the conversation thus far has been conducted with John Quintero, research associate with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by the Southern Women's Show. Food, fashion, and fun, spa treatments, fashion and makeup tips, advice from health professionals, and shopping September 18th through 21st at the Charlotte Merchandise Mart. Tickets at southernshows.com. And by Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, presenting Celtic Crossroads. Seven talented multi-instrumentalists bring a fusion of Irish music to Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater September 27th and 28th. Tickets available at blumenthalcenter.com. .org. Coming up tomorrow on this program, an authentic broadcast. What the heck does that mean? I am told, I know nothing about this topic, rest assured, but I am told that people today want an authentic experience, an experience and products that are authentic. Experience and products that are real, not contrived, not phony, and that the word authentic will be the buzzword of the 21st century. What does all this mean? We'll find out together tomorrow at 9.
Differences over tax policy are a key issue in this year's presidential election. An analysis of John McCain's and Barack Obama's tax policy proposals and what they would mean for the federal budget deficit and your pocketbook. The Diane Rehm Show, Monday.
As always, you're invited to join the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show. It's coming up from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
Public Radio's own David Sedaris is coming back to Charlotte October 11th.
My sister's a type who religiously watches the fear segments of her local eyewitness news broadcast, retaining nothing but the headline. She remembers that applesauce can kill you, but forgets that in order to die, you have to inject it directly into your bloodstream.
This show is sold out, but we've got a pair of tickets to give away. Just go to WFAE.org/tickets for your chance to win. The contest ends on September 21st, so enter now.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to three guests from the North Carolina Justice Center this morning. They've recently released some Census Bureau numbers that indicate that people in North Carolina are not better off than they were 8 years ago. In fact, wages have stagnated while inflation has increased, and more people are falling into poverty. More people, or fewer people, I should say, have health care insurance. Louisa Warren is a policy advocate for the North Carolina Justice Center. John Quintero is a research associate with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, a division of the Justice Center. And Adam Linker is a health policy analyst with the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, another division of the North Carolina Justice Center. They all join us from the studios at WUNC in Chapel Hill. We have an email here from Eric in Concord who writes, when is this country going to see the writing in bright, sickening red all over the wall? Banks are failing left and right. Institutions with a 250-year history are simply going away today since the Great Depression. We've never been closer to complete financial ruin. If people don't see a reason for a political revolution this fall, I don't know when they will. Millions of foreclosures, an underregulated financial system in free fall, an energy crisis of monumental proportions, global climate change, disastrous foreign policy, a war based on misrepresentations and outright lies. Save for the fat cats with the golden parachutes who have, with the assistance of the Bush administration, taken this country to the very precipice, I would say that we are all much worse off today, perhaps worse off than at any other point in our great country's history. Now, this is very political email, but nonetheless, he is, I guess, echoing what the Census Bureau figures would indicate has actually happened to a great degree, correct?
Well, I think we're finding that we are in an economic downturn. There's no denying that. And that 2008, and these are the numbers that really will be the true indicator of how far we've gone down in that economic downturn. Of course, it depends on which economist you ask and which person on the street you ask of whether we're in a full-blown recession or just in a short-term downturn. And I think really we're only going to see whether that's the case going into the future. But I do think the census numbers point to the fact that we are in an unprecedented time in our history, and the fact that in economic terms that we have had an economic expansion in our economy, but folks in North Carolina and across the country have failed to see the benefits of the economic expansion. Excuse me. So I think that's really the big issue. I don't know if I would say this is the single worst time period in our history of the United States, but I do think that folks everywhere are facing significant challenges. Just as an anecdote, many of us were talking this morning that we had to stop at three different gas stations to find gas this morning, which is slightly a separate problem, but that all of us are, whether you're lower income or middle class, facing challenges. And so I think that's a real reality. I think that we do need to take some steps in terms of finding some policy solutions, and we know what they are that are proven to be effective, to make a chance to help working folks weather this economic downturn.
You describe the performance of North Carolina's labor market as being anemic, especially in terms of recovering from a very short recession in 2001, and that the end result is that even today, 8 years later, a smaller share of the population is employed than they were in 2000. Why? Why didn't labor markets recover?
Well, I think that goes back to some of the issues we were talking about earlier, that disconnect between larger economic growth and growth in terms of the improvements in the well-being of families. And really, I think what we saw in the early part of this decade was in some ways the structural reshaping of North Carolina's economy, and we can talk about that in different ways, and that downturn or that restructuring has really set off a whole series of consequences that deal with the ability of companies and firms to create jobs. And when job creation is slack, it's harder for folks to find jobs. It's harder for folks who are employed to move to new jobs or get ahead or push for a better pay. And all of those that contributes to anemic or slow growth in wages and income and feeds right into the top-level numbers we talked about at the beginning of the show.
What do you mean by the structural reshaping of North Carolina's economy? What does that mean?
Well, I think we've seen, and one piece is that definitely the change in our industrial base. We were a state that at one time was much more manufacturing dependent. That type of manufacturing employment has decreased very rapidly in recent years. And the decline in manufacturing, in terms of manufacturing employment, has really exacerbates many of the problems we've talked about. Those types of jobs usually paid solid wages or family supporting wages to folks with modest levels of formal educational attainment. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think you can separate things like the growth in healthcare, the uninsured population, from a change in the kinds of jobs that are out there and the quality of those jobs. Manufacturing jobs, for example, were of a higher quality than some of the jobs that have taken their place.
You say that unemployment rates have increased in every month of 2008, and what's even more telling is the rise of underemployment, which you say is higher. And you also point out that the labor market, the poor labor market, hurts even those who are employed. How so?
Well, I think it hurts folks in a couple of ways. When you have unemployment or growing unemployment in an area, Mike, what you have is hardships for individuals who don't have a job. I mean, they have issues in terms of how they're going to pay their bills. But for folks who are employed, really it makes it harder for them to move to new jobs or to push for better pay because there's a lot of underutilized labor floating around out there, other people who would potentially want a job. So that has an issue in terms of folks who are employed. I think the third thing to keep in mind is that when you have a higher unemployment, it affects not just those without a job, those with jobs, but it also affects everyone because, in a way, when labor is not being used, when talent is not being tapped, that results in a lack of growth. That's almost a foregone opportunity, which results in sort of a collective diminishment in prosperity and opportunity.
The survey shows that 14.3% of North Carolinians live below the poverty level. That's an increase in the past 8 years. It shows that 17.2% of citizens in North Carolina lacked health insurance in 2006 and 2007, up from 15.1% from 2004-05. Is the increase in the number of uninsured due to job layoffs, or is it because those who had been paying for their own health insurance can no longer afford to do so?
It's a combination that basically medical costs are escalating so rapidly that small businesses that were once able to give their employees coverage can no longer afford to do so. Some people who are buying coverage on the individual market are no longer able to afford those premiums. A lot, you know, both nationally and at the state level, a lot of the increase in the number of uninsured has been that decrease in the number of, large employers, small employers, and medium-sized employers who are able to offer insurance.
Yeah, there has been a problem with small businesses, and more people are working for smaller businesses as opposed to the old days when they went to work for big employees. But as this transition began, as small businesses began to be unable to provide health insurance, and this is where we get a little sticky here, I guess, with people out there who are suspicious of why we need some sort of a governmental system. How do we know that the people who are not buying or supplementing their health insurance by buying their own insurance are choosing not to do so because they'd rather buy a new car, or they'd rather buy a big screen television, or they'd rather buy more house than they can really afford, as opposed to buying health insurance? How do we know that?
Well, I guess we have to assume that health insurance is a pretty high priority for a lot of people.
Can we make that assumption given the fact that we have a national obesity epidemic in this country, and if people really cared about their health, they wouldn't overeat? I'm serious about this.
Well, caring about health and caring about health insurance are two different things. I mean, if you have medical debt that's piling on, if you're going to the emergency room because of some obesity related disease, and you see those bills are piling up, clearly then health insurance is a big priority for you. I mean, the real issue is health insurance affordable enough that, you know, health insurance is so expensive in most places that you can't, I mean, it doesn't equal buying a big screen TV. I mean,
it's buying one per month. It's buying
right, exactly. Yeah. right. So you'd have to be, you know, going on quite a spending spree to make up for what you would miss in insurance.
Well, that's why I asked the question, because there is this suspicion going around ever since the time when people called for welfare reform that everybody who is not pulling their own weight is not doing so because they have other priorities which are not necessarily the right priorities. But if you look at the cost of health insurance, it really is the cost of a big screen television every month for some people, and that's simply unaffordable. So the question is, I guess, and we have an email here from Gene who says, well, I could have told you that our economic situation has not improved. What I want to know is what's going to be done about it. So what can be done about this? Louisa, you're calling for federal lawmakers to extend unemployment benefits to help the jobless cope with the loss of income. What else do you believe should be done?
Well, I think in terms of solutions, you have to think in terms of short-term versus long-term. And so in the federal level, I think this is really where the short-term solutions need to happen. And really what we're talking about is a second version of economic stimulus. You may remember that back in May and in early winter that there was economic stimulus. We all got our checks that came through as a result in May or June. And I think we really need a second version of that economic stimulus. And the purpose of economic stimulus is to do some short-term pumping. You pump the money into the economy. You try to give some folks some cash to be able to spend, which then fuels businesses, and that fuels growth, fuels GDP, and that type of thing. And then by the very nature, you end up increasing folks worth at their jobs because they can push for higher wages and that sort of thing. So
Isn't that kind of socialism to benefit business? We're giving citizens money to spend on products and services so that businesses can be healthy.
Well, I think a lot of us, when we saw that first round of economic stimulus, did not actually think that blanket stimulus check was the most effective form of stimulus. And that's why actually folks like us at the Justice Center and a range of organizations and advocates think that really the most effective and biggest bang for your buck is to provide short-term increase in the unemployment insurance benefits and provide a short-term increase in food stamps. Because really, as everybody knows, I think you don't have to be a working poor to notice the rising cost of food prices. So that really we're seeing more at food stamp offices and private food pantries that folks are more middle class that are coming in, that everybody is struggling with this cost of food. And when I say bang for the buck, it's pretty incredible to think about how effective both just an increase in food stamp benefits temporarily and extending the unemployment insurance benefits are. That actually we have shown, and this is the testimony that's been given up on the Capitol Hill. This is from Congressional Budget Office. This is really reliable data that shows if you have a temporary increase in food stamp benefits, that's $1.73 for every dollar that you increase in your food stamp benefits. So that's a huge jump and bang for your buck. It's the same sort of thing with the extension unemployment insurance benefits, that you generate $1.64 for every dollar that you invest in that. So those are effective policies that mean that we're spending our money well when we're giving this temporary relief to folks. And then that's money that's going to affect job creation. It's going to ultimately help folks deal with the strains that they're seeing at home in the grocery stores and by not being able to find a good, well-paying job. And so that's one piece. But then when you think about the long term, what we really need to do is we have to have this short-term job creation. We really need to strengthen the demand for workers, but we also need to strengthen the quality of existing jobs. And so when Adam talks about this erosion of health employer-provided health insurance. What we're also talking about is we have an erosion of general benefits provided at the workplace. That people are working, but these are no longer quality jobs. You know, gone are the days that you didn't have to have a high level of education, but you could read lead a pretty good middle class life, that you essentially worked in the manufacturing industry. Sort of think about that famous sort of Detroit lifestyle, where that you didn't have to have a high education level. Now what we're seeing is that that's not enough, that you need much higher levels of training, that when you're talking about lower-paying jobs or even middle-paying jobs, that they just don't have the type of benefits attached to them, and they don't have wages that actually keep up with inflation, one, but also make work pay, that mean that you actually get by and can provide for your family and pay for child care and provide them with healthy food. I think, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that obesity piece there, that actually it's poorer folks who struggle to buy healthier food, because as you might remember, the Wonder Bread is a lot cheaper than the whole grain organic bread that you might buy at the Whole Foods.
But isn't this part of a systematic destructuring of how things used to be in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s? And with this move away from the labor, this weakening of the labor movement, and the fact that in North Carolina, for instance, you have employment at will. There are no, you can't be forced to join a union, which weakens the unions, etc. So how do people in this situation lobby for better working conditions, for these quality jobs, for health care? How do they make that happen in an environment where this has been systematically reduced?
Well, I don't think North Carolina has ever had a very strong labor community. And I think really what we're talking about when we talk about policies is that we need to go to the people who make those policies. So
but we're in
folks,
a world,
working
we're in,
folks should
but,
talk to their state lawmakers. They should
talk
to their
federal lawmakers.
But we're in a
worldwide economy now. Can we do this if the rest of the world doesn't do it?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind there, Mike, is one of the things that ought to keep in mind is that none of these developments are somehow natural. These aren't things that just occurred because. They aren't like gravity or the sun coming up in the morning. Many of the declines or changes, the weakening of labor market institutions that you referenced, many of the problems we talked about, the shift to job quality, are related to and are the product of deliberate economic and public policy choices.
Yes,
at the
that's what I just said.
Level.
Yes.
But I think that needs to be, I think that's not always made very clear. And so I wanted to touch on that.
All right. But another question along those same lines. In this economy, with a record national debt, with rising national deficits, a floundering national economy, with the mortgage crisis, with government bailouts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac adding to an already overburdened deficit, where will the money come from for all of this additional help to people who desperately need it? No question about it. Where will the money come from?
I think certainly everyone is concerned about our federal government's deficit. And really, there's been a lot of work done to show that the money will come from a very simple source, and that is to shift the tax burden from that which is currently really the majority of the tax burden is on the working poor, the very folks that we're talking about here that are facing stagnating incomes and rising poverty levels, and shifting it to the upper income brackets. And that really that you can look at the numbers that show that if we were to that President Bush in his first term made a number of tax cuts in 2001, and those are all coming up for renewal very shortly. And that if we just let those tax cuts expire, that we would make a significant dent in creating some revenue to really be able to address our deficit. So I think we have to think broader here about the tax structure when we think about how we're going to pay for programs.
Barack Obama says he wants to increase the tax burden on people making more than $250,000 a year and leave the other tax cuts that President Bush has put in place. Would that work? And I have 15 seconds, 10 seconds.
I definitely think that there's some of the modeling shows that would generate some additional revenues and lead to a fairer tax structure.
Okay, hang on for a second. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Corporate Information Technologies, assisting companies with business continuity and disaster recovery through server virtualization. Details available at corpinfotech.com. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, whose new progress report features digital media innovators. More online at knightfoundation.org. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, guest host Susan Page is in from USA Today for the vacationing Diane, and top advisors from both the McCain and Obama campaigns react to the changing landscape on Wall Street as Lehman Brothers declares bankruptcy and Merrill Lynch sells itself to Bank of America. That's in the first hour. In the 11 o'clock hour, Americans are now living 30 years more than they did 100 years ago. And a journalist, Maggie Scarf, explores what these bonus years mean for people in long-term marriages. Her book is called September Songs, and she'll talk about that with Susan Page in the 11 o'clock hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@WFAE.org, and you can join us on our blog at WFAE.org/charlotteblogs. We'll return in just 60 seconds. Stay with us.
As political campaigns heat up, so does media coverage of this year's elections.
At a campaign stop in Dover, New Hampshire today.
She seems a little more comfortable in the political arena than she does the foreign policy.
Join WFAE for a community dialogue with a panel of local journalists and media experts on the media's role in election 2008. Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 8 at Charlotte's Mint Museum of Art. Details and registration at our website, WFAE.org.
Looking to get your news fix for the day? Tune in to hear the latest in politics?
I have not done anything that is wrong in the process of my official activities.
To what's happening in the arts?
The theater became my religion, and I wanted to serve it.
Wake up to the world with Morning Edition from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our conversation this morning was precipitated by the fact that the Census Bureau in August released statistics that say that from 2000 to 2007, North Carolinians are not better off than they were at the beginning of that time period. In fact, they are worse off, and more people can't afford health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And we're talking about this with Louisa Warren, who is a policy advocate with the North Carolina Justice Center, John Quintero, research associate with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, which is a division of the Justice Center, and another division of the Justice Center, the North Carolina Health Access Coalition. We'll be talking about health care and their proposals in this segment. Is Adam Linker, he's the health policy analyst for them. I know that you have several suggestions. We've talked about what to do about this a little bit in the previous segment, but one of the things you're also advocating is a stronger minimum wage and what you call more realistic employment standards, like paid sick leave on a more robust and a more robust earned income tax credit. So talk about those things for a second. How would they help?
Sure. All the policies that you mentioned are about strengthening existing jobs. So again, what's happening is that folks are working long hours. That's not the problem here. Sometimes they're working two jobs to be able to pay for those high costs of health care and child care, for example. But they're not able to get by, one, because the wages have not kept up with inflation. They have not kept up with the rising cost of goods and services that we have to use and consume to be able to get by. And another reason is that folks just don't have the same type of workplace benefits that they used to have in those good quality jobs that you used to be able to get in the manufacturing industry or those type of things. So folks don't have things like paid sick days where they can just take a day off to be able to care for their loved ones, or take a sick child and stay home with them without threat of losing their job or losing a day's pay. When we talk about the earned income tax credit, this is one of the singularly most effective policies that the United States has in terms of providing relief for working folks. And what the earned income tax credit is, it's a federal program that provides relief to folks that are among a certain income bracket, and essentially they get a refund on their tax. And we just enacted in North Carolina 2 years ago a 3.5% state refundable earned income tax credit. So this is folks who are working, who are making an income, but they are making such a low income that this is to provide them a little bit of extra money in their pockets to be able to, again, stimulate the economy, pay for basic things. So
that is something that the state or the federal government can do, because that's in their control. But what about paid sick leave? What about better employment benefits like health care? You can't, I suppose you could, but at the moment they haven't mandated that, and if they did, what would the impact be?
Right. In terms of paid sick leave, there is not currently any law in North Carolina that requires businesses to provide paid sick leave. But the way we feel about it is that there are nearly half of North Carolinians do not have a single hour of paid sick time guaranteed in their workplaces to be able to take time off to go to a doctor's appointment, do preventative care, take their kid to get immunized before they start school. And so at a certain point, when you're talking about such a sizable population, there is a role for government to play and to set a basic minimum workplace standard and require that businesses provide their employees with paid sick leave. So that's what we're really talking about there. Government has long stepped in and created a bottom wage floor, which is what the minimum wage is, recognizing that it helps create a standard for the rest of the society to govern itself by. And so paid sick leave is something that the United States lags behind every other competitive economy in the world in terms of providing this benefit along with others, such as paid family and medical leave, maternity leave, paternity leave. But really, we just think it's the basic thing that folks should be able to have access to a paid hour or paid time off to be able to take care of themselves or their loved ones.
Justin in Concord writes, your guest said before the break that the majority of the tax burden is on the working poor. Dry that out, he says, and you can fertilize the lawn. According to the IRS, people making more than $150,000 a year paid 60% of the taxes. People making more than $65,000 paid 87% of taxes. There are solutions, but one of them is not higher taxes. If that's true, if those figures are right, and I don't know that they are, but if people making more than $65,000 paid 87% of the taxes, doesn't that leave the working poor or people making less than $65,000 shouldering a substantially lower amount of the burden?
I think what you have to keep in mind when you look at the tax numbers, Mike, is which tax are you talking about? If you looked at just the federal income tax numbers, like those that the caller or the person who emailed said, may make sense, but you have to look at the broader context. When you add in state taxes, when you add in local taxes, when you add in the payroll tax, which is the biggest tax that most folks pay, their Social Security taxes, when you add all of that together and look at the tax system as a whole, you get to the distribution that Louisa mentioned earlier, where more of the burden is at the other end of the spectrum.
Okay. Congress just recently passed, I believe, didn't they, an increase in the minimum wage? Is that right?
Yes.
What has been the impact of that, and are you calling for yet another increase in the minimum wage?
The minimum wage, Congress passed it, and it's phasing up gradually, and by next summer it will be at $7.25 an hour. And that's a positive step forward. I think we definitely have talked about increasing the wage again to get it back to the same value it had in 1968. If you took what the minimum wage was in 1968 and adjusted it for inflation, if it had just kept even, as we've talked about earlier, today the minimum wage would be around $10 an hour. Mm. So if you want to try to strengthen employment standards, improve the quality of jobs, a higher minimum wage, or at least getting it back to where it was 40 years ago, would be a positive step in that direction.
Let me bring some callers into this discussion. Lynn in Monroe, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Thank you. My question, or my thought rather, was are there other types of stimulus packages, and I use that term kind of loosely here, are there other types of things that we can do for them with regard to education, with regard to working training, as opposed to this blanket kind of give them more food stamps, let's let the government bail them out kind of attitude? I'm kind of tired of that. That sense of entitlement kind of bothers me. And I do have a history. I have a history both being under the poverty line and living in that kind of environment and receiving public assistance while I went to college. All three of my kids, remember mom and dad both going to college and kind of pulling ourselves out of that. And there really is something to be said for that pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality.
Well, you are calling, are you not, for other kinds of stimulus as opposed to just food stamps and things like that? You're calling for better investment in community colleges to improve the number of skilled workers, correct?
Oh, yes. I mean, we definitely look at things as being very comprehensive. So the types of ideas that Louisa talked about for strengthening the quality of jobs is very important. but we also look at the ideas about what can you do to help people invest in their skills and develop the education and training needed to move to different opportunities.
Are there skilled jobs out there for skilled? In other words, if we increased funding to community colleges, if people took advantage of that, they became more able to take a hold of a skilled job. Are the jobs out there for those people in North Carolina?
Yes. If you look at many of the
people who are interested in that. Are there a lot of people who are really, really pushing for that and saying to you or to others who are in this industry, hey, this is what I need. I want this. And are people really hearing that, or are they just turning around and saying, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Here's your food stamps, and we'll see you next month.
Well, I think those types of policies have a place. If you look about in terms of education and training, I think what you're seeing in North Carolina is, in many ways, people voting with their feet. If you look at recent years, enrollment, for example, at our community colleges across the state have shot up pretty sharply. So I think that shows that when people are getting the message and are looking to seize the opportunities that are out there. But that also raises some questions then about financial aid and cost and those sorts of factors. Mm-hmm.
But you're saying, let's be clear about this, you are saying that there are skilled jobs out there waiting for skilled workers. If we could fill the jobs, they would be filled.
There's definitely, in fields, if you look at some of the projections, for example, from the State Department of Commerce, they estimate that over the next 10 years, every year of the next 10 years, we have approximately a shortage of approximately 20,000 workers who have the type of credential you'd get from a community college.
Are those skilled jobs, are those what you would call quality jobs? Are they providing health care benefits? Are they providing paid sick leave, maternity leave, et cetera?
They are more of what we would call middle skill jobs, things in fields like the building trades, in vocational fields, and those are fields that definitely have a higher percentage or higher share of quality jobs than you might find in things like retail, for example.
Lynn, thank you.
So there's more opportunity.
Thank you for your call, Lynn. I'm going to go to Mike. Mike in Rock Hill, welcome. Hi, Mike.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome.
Hi.
Hello. I had a question, actually a comment and a question. I'm curious what everybody thinks about green-collar jobs, because really, to me, it seems like the issue is everybody's talking about these quick fixes, all these ways that we can shift this dollar over here to fix this person. The last caller even kind of talked about this cultural idea that I want to comment on, is that don't we need to really kind of focus on how we can bring the United States back to an industry-based country? I mean, we're throwing jobs across the ocean, and we're becoming a very service-oriented economy. That's destroying us. I'm wondering what these economists think about green-collar jobs. Can we transform the way we use energy into a way that we transform our culture and our economy?
Well, I think we've been paying a lot of attention to these developments around green-collar jobs. I mean, what I would say is that it's certainly a hot topic right now. A lot of folks are talking about it. I think it presents a lot of opportunities, and this is really representing the alliance of sort of all the folks who are concerned about climate change, and these are folks who are concerned about the environment, and really aligning them with folks who are concerned about job creation. So I think it's potentially a really powerful coalition and alignment. I think the question we have to raise is we really don't know that much about what green jobs really are, and how much job creation they're going to create, and how much skills you really need to be able to do these various types of green jobs. I mean, it's one thing to be able to clean off a solar panel in New Mexico, and that could be termed a green job. It's another thing to be able to go into the factory somewhere and put together the type of LED light bulb. So there's different skill sets out there, and I think we have a lot to learn about what actually green jobs are. In some ways, it raises the same issues that we've always been grappling with in terms of workforce development and job creation, which are we need skills and training for them, as John was talking about, investments in community colleges, and we also need to make sure that if we're going to invest a whole bunch in this creation of green jobs and create incentives and subsidies for them, that we need to make sure that they're those good quality jobs, because else we're going to find ourselves in the same situation as we're currently in, and that the jobs don't pay, and we don't have the skilled laborers to get into them.
And there are politicians on the stump right now saying that green jobs can't be outsourced. That cannot be true.
Well, I think it depends, as Louisa said, what exactly do you mean by green jobs? Right now there's a lot of talk, and I think not necessarily much cohesion around what the issue involves. At its, I think, at one potential with the green jobs is that many of them are really those kinds of middle-skilled jobs I was talking about a moment ago with the last caller. The idea that, for example, the building trades types of professions, those could be green jobs, but you're essentially using a different kind of technology or process. I mean, the skills of a carpenter or plumber are the same. You're just using different tools and techniques.
Mike, thank you for your call. We're almost out of time, and I don't want to leave this program without talking about your suggestions for health care, because the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, which is Adam Linker's area of expertise, has a vision for how health care should work in North Carolina. Every family deserves a family doctor and quality health care. Health insurance shouldn't cost more because of a pre-existing condition. People should not have to choose between moving to a better job and staying with a job that provides health care coverage. Businesses providing good health care coverage to employees shouldn't have to compete with employers that offer no coverage at all. These are great goals. How do you achieve them?
It's not going to be easy, but I think that we need leadership at the state level who can really push this as opposed to just waiting for Washington to do something, which is why we came out with this plan. And what it's really about is creating affordable options for small businesses, creating affordable options for people on the individual healthcare market. And so, you know, basically what it does is expand popular public programs. It allows you to keep your health insurance if you have it through a large sort of stable employer and you're happy with your insurance, you can keep it. But then it also creates a public-private partnership that would create more affordable choice healthcare plans for small businesses, a sort of deep discount program that would allow small businesses to buy into so that more employers can offer insurance instead of less. And then it also, one of the things that every plan has to incorporate is somehow trying to contain healthcare costs, because that's one of the things that's driving the inability of small businesses to offer insurance.
Well, one of the things you're suggesting is to ban insurance companies from charging higher rates or denying full coverage for people with pre-existing health conditions. I'm not sure how you mandate that, but, well, you can talk about that in a second. But you also advocate everyone contributing to their own health care coverage, correct?
Right.
So
yes,
talk about both of those things very quickly.
We think everybody, there should be sliding scale premiums, but everybody who's able to should certainly contribute through copays or through deductibles. Employers who don't offer insurance eventually should have some sort of penalty where they're contributing to the system. Hospitals should contribute to the system. Insurance companies should contribute so that we really are everyone is sharing the burden and it's not concentrated on one
industry. Should and must are two different words. So how do you make this happen?
Well, I think that we're not going to make it happen all at once. No state has made it happen all at once. But there are 17 states ahead of us who have made a lot of this happen. And really, it's just one step at a time, starting with insuring all children, we think, then insuring all parents, and then creating a deep discount for small businesses.
Are you optimistic that, given the prevailing political winds, that this can actually happen?
I'm very optimistic.
Really? Are you really?
I am. We have to be in our profession.
All right, well, that's another show. We'll have to have you back to talk about that. Adam Linker is the health policy analyst for the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, John Quintero, research associate with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, and Louisa Warren, policy advocate with the North Carolina Justice Center. Thank you all for joining us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our program is made possible in part today by Dr. James Altizer and the Vein Center of Charlotte, providing state-of-the-art outpatient treatment for varicose and spider veins. Trust the vein specialist, 704-341-1122, and by the Greater Charlotte Cultural Trust, ensuring performance, discovery, and enlightenment for future generations, creating a lasting legacy with the bequest to a favorite cultural organization. Information at charlottecultureltrust.org.
Allergies. Lots of us have them. They're annoying, but cat dander and hay fever are nothing. Food allergies take that top prize, and labels aren't much help.
What's the difference between may contain peanuts and processed in a facility? Is the risk the same? We have no idea.
Me neither. I'm Kai Rizdahl, understanding those allergy warnings, next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
That's Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Despite the hordes of people who flock to Disney World and other amusement venues, most of the time people want an authentic experience. They want to buy products that are real, not contrived, not phony. They respond to things that are engaging, personal, memorable, authentic. In fact, some say that the word authentic will be the buzzword of the 21st century. But just exactly what does authentic mean? We'll find out when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Partly sunny with scattered showers and thunderstorms today. High should be in the middle 80s tonight. More of the same and rain likely tomorrow with cooler temperatures, lower 70s. It's 77 now at WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.
From WHE.